The Middle East and its complex web of relationships, energy, interests, and trade routes have continued to make the region important to the United States. Ambassador Thomas Pickering says after the disappointing U.S. wars in both Afghanistan and Iraq over the last decade, the region as a whole still demands America's attention.
Regardless of what your opinion might be on the various polls about the popularity, declining popularity, lack of popularity of the United States in the region, it's quite fascinating that when something major happens, usually Washington gets the first phone calls. People want to know what the United States thinks, what it intends to do.
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, Ambassador Thomas Pickering, a career ambassador and former U.S. representative to the United Nations, shares his thoughts on the challenges facing the U.S. in the Middle East. That's coming up, but first, here's this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today we're airing a talk recorded last week by Ambassador Thomas Pickering. Pickering is a career ambassador for the U.S. State Department, the highest rank in the U.S. Foreign Service. He served as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs from 1997 to 2000, and he served as U.S. Ambassador to the Russian Federation, India, Israel, El Salvador, Nigeria, and Jordan. He also was the U.S. Ambassador and Representative to the United Nations. This past week, he spoke at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, mainly about the challenges America faces in the Middle East. His talk was recorded on January 13th, 2016.
Middle East, from the perspective of the United States, is, of course, outside of our European heritage. But in many ways, if you look at the kinds of things that in one way historically have affected our country in seminal ways, it is hard to divorce, for example, American religious life from its Middle Eastern origins. And in many ways, that heavily has influenced things like our value structure, our ways of thinking about morality, our ideas on law and where it fits, all of which I think went through their own metamorphoses in Europe, and the transmission was via Europe. But if we go back to the deeper roots, we do have a very strong and I think abiding relationship with the Middle East, heavily influenced by this nation's deep devotion in one way or another to religion, far more than many others that I've served in. And I've had the unusual opportunity for an American diplomat to have been the ambassador in the only Jewish country, ambassador in the largest Hindu country, ambassador in a Muslim country, ambassador in a Roman Catholic country, ambassador in the largest Orthodox Christian country. So I've had an opportunity to see a lot of religion and religious background and religious influences in everything from everyday to politics to social and human life. But that's not the only relationship. We have historical and indeed continuing deep ties to the area. And when I say that, I think most people automatically think of Israel and our strong relationship with Israel, which has persisted over the years. A relationship that has not been either untroubled or untroubling for many, but a relationship that is perhaps based both on our sense of respect for the first of the three closely tied monotheistic religions, which have a predominant role in the planet's life today. And a set of relationships that obviously comes out of the horrible tragedy of the Holocaust in the Second World War, and a sense of both admiration and some concern about the implantation of the Jewish state in the Middle East and what has happened as a result to the Palestinians who were inhabitants of the country and how and in what way that issue can be brought to brook. But it is also true that Christianity has deep roots in the Middle East, and we've had historical roots in the region. It strikes me as a little weird that we would have sent American missionaries in the 19th century to convert the Christians of the Middle East to Christianity. But in effect, obviously, that was a sectarian idea. And so one of the fascinating questions that the rather poorly equipped American occasionally asks of a Middle Eastern Christian, how long have you been Christian? And of course, the answer is usually from the beginning. And so that set of ties, which flourished into educational establishments and all kinds of other linkages, and strong relationships over the years with many countries, Muslim, Arabic speaking, that have gone through their own ups and downs, particularly recently, have been an important part of the American tie to the Middle East and vice versa. We fought perhaps our first serious naval war after an undeclared war with the French against the Mediterranean Muslim principalities who, among other things, had established their own navies and found that capturing the merchant ships of other states was a good way to stay on top of the financial heap. We call them the Barbary Pirates, but I think we would have closer and more exact terms to discuss them, the then 19th century leaders in Algiers, in Tunis, in Tripoli, and other small ports on the southern coast of the Mediterranean. And of course, the thing that people think about all the time is the energy relationship and how significant and important that is. And we are in a little bit of a jag now in the United States about our energy independence. And indeed, it has been an important change. It's had a significant influence on the price of hydrocarbons. And it has had a significant influence, I think, on the sense that perhaps people at one point overanalyzed American policy as being dependent on the diktats of the Middle Eastern oil producers, and now perhaps underestimate their importance. We live in a globe, and our increasing prosperity in many ways is increasingly tied to trade, and trade is with our friends, allies, and trading partners. And large numbers of those are not as fortunate in their energy position as we are. And so the role and place of the energy producers, wherever they are, but principally in the Middle East, is still very significant and very important as we look at the broader and more substantial interests of the United States in that part of the world. We also, I think, have an increasing sense after the last two conflicts, which have now morphed into two more conflicts, if I can say so, in Afghanistan and in Iraq and now in Syria, a geopolitical and, put it this way, security relationship with the region, which has played, and I think will continue to play, an important role in American policy. And as I talk about it, I think that will be apparent. And so it is this web of relationships, perhaps also buttressed a good bit by the position of the Middle East across many of the great transit ways of both passengers and freight, by sea, by air, by land, that tie the globe together, that also makes the Middle East important to us. And so as we look at it, it is something not just because of the problems that we have faced in the Middle East, but because of these other factors which have dictated, if I could put it this way, our continued attention to those problems, that's important. I believe, in fact, as well, that regardless of what your opinion might be on the various polls about the popularity, declining popularity, lack of popularity, or slightly regained popularity of the United States in the region, It's quite fascinating that when something major happens, usually Washington gets the first phone calls. People want to know what the United States thinks, what it intends to do, where it intends to go. I've just come from lunch. I was on an airplane at 7 o'clock this morning, so I saw that Iran had released the U.S. sailors. But I hadn't yet caught up, as I did at lunch, very vicariously, with Secretary Kerry's statement that both he planned to have the next meeting on Syria on the 24th of January, and that according to the news that I heard, Iran and Saudi Arabia would attend, and that, in my view, is an important recovery, if indeed it is a recovery, or at least a forward step in a situation which would have otherwise turned my talk today six shades bleaker. So we obviously, I think, want to stay right up with the news on the region.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Thomas Pickering is a career ambassador for the U.S. State Department, having served as U.S. ambassador to the Russian Federation, India, Israel, El Salvador, Nigeria, and Jordan. He spoke last week at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today, we are airing a talk given last week by Ambassador Thomas Pickering. He's a career ambassador who has worked in various capacities on Middle East issues and negotiations. He shared his thoughts last week on the current challenges the U.S. now faces in the Middle East.
So how do I see the problems, and where do I see them, and what are the things that we should be looking ahead to be doing in the region? If I were giving this talk 5 years ago, I'd probably stick with the three I-word countries, Iran, Iraq, and Israel, and its neighbors. And now we, of course, have had the Arab Spring. I prefer to call it the Arab Transformation as a slightly more diplomatic word which doesn't seek in one way or another to characterize the change, because I find it very difficult in this day and age to come to grips with the notion of the change. Is it first and foremost good or bad for the people in the region? Unfortunately, I think more bad than good up till now. Where will it go? Is it good or bad for the United States? And I think by the same judgment, by the same criteria, probably not good for the United States or indeed for the rest of the world. But it is, I think, significant that we might pay a little bit of attention to a few of those. I like to begin with Iran. I used to begin with Iran because it was the hardest problem. Now I can say with some confidence that the other problems have become harder. And so beginning with Iran might be beginning with a more optimistic piece at the moment rather than one of the more difficult and challenging. But if we were still speaking today and the American sailors looked like they were going to spend 444 days in Iran, and the Iranian political framework had become polarized, and there were new steps taken between Saudi Arabia and Iran to raise the level, if not of hostilities, of animosity and contention, we would have that kind of a situation. What's important, I think, for the U.S. and Iran at the moment is the following. After a long negotiation, we, together with our other negotiating partners, have been able to put together an agreement that those of us who have followed this with care, and I began looking at this back in 2002 as sort of maybe a hope that might occur, that this is an agreement that has far exceeded what I believed would be possible to negotiate. It's an agreement that is based on three very simple ideas. One, that while it is not possible to negotiate an end to Iran's nuclear program, it was, and I think it has been, conceivable to negotiate limitations on that program that both serve to keep it from advancing military nuclear goals on the one hand, and secondly, were they to do so in violation of the agreement, that we have at least a year to decide what to do in that problem, with that problem. And that has involved important steps like both reducing the amount of enriched nuclear material Iran can keep, in this case to a ridiculously small amount, 300 kilograms, 600 pounds, which is not enough in and of itself, even if taken to higher levels of enrichment, to produce enough fissile material for a single nuclear weapon. And reduce the number of centrifuges so that against that base of a very low stockpile of partially enriched uranium, it would take at least a year or more to put those centrifuges in operation to produce the necessary quantity for a single nuclear weapon, and to take them out of the business of creating a nuclear weapon by the second route, by using plutonium, which is the byproduct, interestingly enough, of burning uranium in a reactor most widely for the purpose of creating electrical energy. So all electrical energy nuclear plants make plutonium as a byproduct. And they had built most of, but not completely, a reactor in Iran which was in its own way, its type, design, and configuration, ideal for the production of plutonium. That reactor has got to be changed, and I believe the work is far advanced in doing that. So not only can it not produce in a year anything like a militarily useful quantity of plutonium, but Iran has agreed to export all of the spent fuel, the used fuel containing plutonium, as it supports that reactor. And Iran has agreed not to investigate or participate for 15 years in the processes that have to take place to be able to separate the plutonium from the spent fuel. And then finally, there has been, to the satisfaction of the International Atomic Energy Agency, in the agreement, a long and careful investigation into activities that Iran undertook mainly between 1998 and 2003, which were much more consistent with a military weapon program than they were with a civilian program. And those, according to American intelligence, and Israel intelligence and joins them in this, stopped in 2003 and have not been resumed. And we continue still to believe, our intelligence establishments, with very high confidence, that Iran has not made a decision to make a nuclear weapon. These particular sets of activities will soon face another change point. We will go from, actually starting the process under the agreement to full implementation. Full implementation means that Iran will have taken, to the satisfaction of the international inspectors, all of the steps that were required, 12 of them, before we are required to take away the nuclear sanctions on Iran. Iran has been anxious to do this, has moved rapidly to do so. There have been no reports of errors, and where there have been differences, they have been rapidly solved to the satisfaction of the United States and the other parties that negotiated the agreement with Iran, in large measure because Iran is facing an election at the end of February, both for its parliament and for one of its very important assemblies, a committee of experts that plays a very important role in choosing the next leader in Iran. It's quite clear that the Rouhani administration, which has led things in Iran to putting the agreement together and implementing it, believes, in fact, that if it can produce some positive reactions as a result of the agreement through the lifting of sanctions, it can succeed in the election in still controlling the parliament and putting people on the assembly of experts who are sympathetic to its views. So that will be important. This has also led to other things. Very briefly, it's been clear that for some years in Afghanistan, the U.S. and Iran shared a common view that they could not support a Taliban government in Afghanistan. Iran, because it is a Shia majority country, and the Taliban are a Sunni organization. We, because we support the elected government of Afghanistan, and the Taliban have, as you know, been in arms against that government now for many years. Very little has been done on Afghanistan, but we are not at cross purposes, although at some times in the past we have been. More importantly, we have common views on the Islamic State, and that in part because Iraq is, of course, now a country run by the Shia majority, it has played an important role in trying to recover the territories it lost, both in its north and west, to the Islamic State over the last year and a half. Some of that has begun, but not very much. Iran has played a role in training Shia militias and elements of the Iraqi army. We have, in the United States, been training the Sunni minority in Iraq, to the extent that it's available for that kind of training, also to participate in the recovery of the country from the Islamic State. And while we've had a tendency, in my view, much too much to look at this as purely a military problem, and you heard words like destroy or dominate or get rid of or whatever, with respect to the Islamic State, and it is difficult, I think, for Americans, from what they see of the Islamic State, to enjoy a great deal of sympathy with them or with their goals, there is a significant political element in what has to be done, and that is how and in what way, in the Sunni majority areas, can it be possible to begin to take advantage of some of the disintegration one is seeing now in the Islamic State's rule to recruit, train, and bring to bear those Sunnis who would separate themselves or would be likely to separate themselves from the Islamic State in the recovery of those territories for Iraq. And it is complicated by the fact that, as many of you know, in 2006 and 2007, the conflict in Iraq, when we were deeply engaged there, was fundamentally changed by our ability over a period of time in those years to work with the Sunni minority and with them to help stabilize the military situation. I'm careful in my words here because I think it's a mistake to promise too much or to imply too much in a very difficult, unpredictable, and hard-to-judge situation. But having, in fact, left Iraq for whatever good or bad reasons, that Sunni minority felt both deserted by the United States, but also left in the hands of a somewhat triumphalist Shia majority. And under Prime Minister Maliki, perhaps more than under the current Prime Minister Abadi, the Shia rule was not very tolerant, not very helpful, not very participatory with respect to the Sunni majority. So the Sunni majority is both discouraged by the Shia majority leadership in Iraq and discouraged by the United States having abandoned them in the course of its own departure from Iraq. And so finding a way to put this process on a different course is the need to find a way to couple majority rule with minority rights. Something we talk about, something we know about, something at times we don't do very well, something that's very hard to do in the Middle East, with the differences coming out of historical differences and recent conflict, which is hard to bridge over. But I think a mistake on our part is to look at this just as a military endeavor and not as one involving a very significant political role and element, not just to deal with the Islamic State, but in my view, to deal with the long-term capacity of an Iraq, both to remain together and to be an effective nation state on its own. The problem is further complicated by the fact that Syria is also coupled in the equation in a very important way. The Islamic State has its origins in Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They moved into northern Syria, and then when weakness appeared in northern Iraq, moved back, and now dominate big pieces of northeastern Syria and northern and northwestern Iraq and down into Anbar province in western Iraq. The Syrian part of the issue grew out of the conflict that grew up in Syria 3.5 or 4 years ago with the public demonstrations against Assad's government at the time. Over a period of time, they continued to be peaceful. As far as I can tell, the government was the first to resort use of military force against the peaceful demonstrations. That led into a civil war. It led into some concluding that because color revolutions had been taking place both in Eastern Europe and in the Arabic-speaking world, they were somehow destined to succeed in good time. In fact, there were many friends of mine who knew the region reasonably well who were telling me that in 4 months Assad would be gone. That didn't eventuate. My own concern was that given what I knew about the control of Syria by President Assad, by his Alawite minority, an offshoot but not part of Shiism, by the loyalty of some of the minorities in Syria to the Assad regime, which didn't disappear with the outbreak of fighting, including Christians, including some Sunni, including originally the Kurds, that it would be a long, difficult, and perhaps not militarily resolvable problem. And I think that's what we have. For some time, over the last 2.5 years, the United Nations has been seeking, on the basis of almost everybody's conclusion, and I include the Russians in this, I'm a frequent visitor to Moscow and started talking as early as April 2013 to the Russians about what I thought was the high unlikelihood of a military solution in Syria, particularly one that they wanted, the victory of President Assad, that they had to begin to think about whether, in fact, a political workout was important, and said to them that I thought back then that there would be increasing radicalization of the groups opposing President Assad if we were not prepared to try to do something about dealing with the problem effectively. Both former Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, and his successors, one of whom was Lakhdar Brahimi, the former foreign minister of Algeria, and now a a Swede with an Italian name, Stefan Di Mistura, have all been working on this problem. And if you had asked me in September, did I think there was any progress possible, I would have said no. I would have said that most people I speak with who watch Syria believe that there are four steps that need to be taken in some order, but none of them knew whether there was any way to persuade enough Syrians that these steps had to be taken to move. And the steps were really ceasefire and humanitarian relief, and we know the tragedy of the refugee problem. We know even more the tragedy of the 250,000 or more deaths in the civil war, and we know the fact that between 8 and 12 million people in one way or another in Syria have been either internally or externally displaced by the fighting. And so it is, in every serious way, a world-class catastrophe. What happened, interestingly enough, was that in late September and early October, for reasons that I think had to do with, one, that the Iranians told the Russians that they thought that Assad was losing ground, seriously, both to ISIS, to some of the other fronts that are close to ISIS, and to some of the moderate Free Syrian Army people. Both in northern Syria and in central Syria being important because it's the land link between the major Alawite area in northwest Syria and Damascus. And I think that helped to move Russian air forces, some ground troops, and a bombing campaign forward. What was even more interesting, and it took a while to notice this, as at almost the same time, Secretary Kerry began to have more productive talks with Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister. And by the end of October, not only had they put together a new meeting on Syria, but I think in large measure because Kerry spent significant amount of time in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, and perhaps President Obama as well, they were able to persuade for the first time the Saudis to come to a meeting at which the Iranians were present. And so, aside from the fact there were no Syrians yet participating in this exercise, which is central to its success, you had Russia and the United States, you had Iran and Saudi Arabia, you had Turkey, you had Qatar in the Gulf, which has put a lot of money into Syria. You had some of the other Gulf countries and a few of the Europeans. And coming out of this first meeting, it was possible for them jointly to endorse both a ceasefire and a transitional government. And in fact, they seem to be leaning more toward a transitional government, recognizing that ceasefires would be hard to get, even though for at least a year, in parts of Syria, there have been informal ceasefires in place because people understood the futility of continued killing and its absolute lack of progress. Fatigue. A second meeting in Vienna reordered the priorities and asked Saudi Arabia if they would bring together, I guess what can best be called the non-radical opposition to Assad. Not all of them came, but many came, and asked Jordan to take a look at some of the definitional problems, the really trying question of who was a terrorist. And if you look at Syria, of course, everybody's got their favorite terrorists, and they're not all the same people. Jordan's problem, I think, resulted in a chart that showed how each country voted on who was a terrorist. But it had no conclusion, because it couldn't. But the Saudi effort had a conclusion, that these people were prepared to come forward and they were prepared to work along the lines of the matrix that had been set out by the second conference. And now we have, hopefully, a third conference at the end of this month, which will perhaps have an opportunity to have Syrians come. The Syrians agreed they would sit at a conference in which Assad's representatives appeared. And the Assad problem, of course, is a major problem. But in my view as well, the role and place of how in Syria ISIS will be dealt with remains to be a major question before that conference. And so what one doesn't yet see is how all of those pieces will fit on the board, much less be put together in a coherent way. But they're beginning. And the ability, even with the dust-up between Saudi Arabia and Iran, to keep it together is an important and significant fact if it holds up and moves ahead. Why did the Saudis do what they do? Well, it depends, I guess, what your point of view is. One point of view, a simple one, is that they had reached the conclusion that they had to act forcefully to continue to have the confidence of the Sunni majority in Saudi Arabia, but the bulk of the people that they were going to act forcefully against were Sunnis. And so they had to include some Shia in the mix. Nimr al-Nimr, the Shia sheikh who was executed, has a checkered reputation. Some claim that he's spoken out violently against the Saudi government, and that's the reason why he was arrested. Others claim that he's a real hero and nothing but a good theologian. I don't have enough background to tell you where I think the real answer is. Everybody can read the record and make their own opinion. But the timing couldn't have been worse. The timing came at a period when we were about to move toward implementation of the nuclear agreement. Many feel that the choice of the sheikh to execute was precisely designed to see whether, in fact, the Saudis could disrupt the agreement, which they didn't agree with. And that may well be the case. I don't know. But it couldn't have come at a worse time. Whatever happened in Tehran, and the Saudis, of course, believe it was all inspired by the government in Tehran, but the government in Tehran has acted rather forcefully against those who burned and took over the Saudi embassy. So we'll see. My view has been all along that the Iranians have wanted to talk to the Saudis much more than the Saudis have wanted to talk to the Iranians. The problem is intimately tied up with, of course, Yemen, and we can talk more about that. Saudi-Iranian cooperation will be absolutely necessary for a political resolution of what's happening in Yemen. The military process is changing, I think, against the Houthi Shia, who at one point controlled nearly the entire country. But one doesn't know and see where the military process will go, except to believe that this is yet again another one of those candidates where a political solution may have more possibilities now than it had 4 months ago. And whether the process that Kerry has started can keep going and be applied to Yemen or not remains open.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today we are broadcasting a talk given last week by Thomas Pickering. Pickering is a career ambassador for the U.S. State Department. He spoke about the challenges facing the United States in the Middle East today.
I've talked a long time, but I'm going to spend just 5 minutes on the Arab-Israeli question, which I think at one point or another has been the mother of all problems in the Middle East, still plays a major role despite the fact that it tends from time to time to come up and down in people's consciousness. The major question, obviously, is can there be a political resolution of the differences between the Israelis and the Palestinians over the territorial question in what years ago was the old British Mandate of Palestine. And the question there has been debated and discussed almost endlessly. There's no question in my mind that the principal problem is that on both sides, there are hugely important domestic political questions that one way or another, in their own fashion but in different ways, have made it very hard for both Israelis and Palestinians to try to bring themselves to address the difficult compromises that would have to be made. Many have suggested that the two-state solution is dead. The real problem with that, none of them have been able to demonstrate that there is another solution that can work. A one-state solution for the Israelis is they control everything, and the Palestinians stay under occupation. And that's certainly not a solution the Palestinians will accept. A one-state solution for the Palestinians is that they will run the country, they have a majority, and it'll be a democracy. And sooner or later, they will come to the fore. And of course, the Israelis are unwilling to accept that kind of a solution. And so you're driven back to this point. The second point I would make, it's a peculiar idea of my own, you won't hear it elsewhere, I don't think, is that for 35 years we have waited and worked on the political leadership to produce the breakthrough. Now I think it is up to the United States to produce the breakthrough and see if we can use that to corral the political leadership. And the breakthrough, in my view, would be that the U.S., for the first time, in a serious public way, would take a position on the 5, 6, 7, 8 major questions that out there exist to be resolved to find a two-state solution, and that the U.S. attempt to do so in as fair and equitable way as it can. For too long, we have, over one administration or another, said we will never put forward a solution to the problem on our own unless the Israelis agree. And that's not a formula for success. It may be a formula for friendship, but it's not a formula for success. Similarly, if we took it the other way around, it would not be a formula for success. So when we put forward a position, we're going to have to make both sides mad as hell. And that's not something that's going to be easily done. But in fact, if both sides are mad as hell, we probably have a solution. If one side loves it and the other side hates it, there is no solution. And so we have to find a way to be brutally fair. And in being brutally fair, if I could put it this way, distribute the pain. And I think brutal fairness will distribute the pain. And I have thoughts and ideas about how to do this. We could discuss that at length. It's not the time to lay out what it is we should do. But I think first and foremost, we should say, if we're going to do this to both sides, we're going to put forward our ideas. They are going to be stated in very succinct terms as matters of principle. They are not going to be a treaty, and it is not going to be a diktat. But it will do two things. It will rule out our support, and I believe through us, broad international support for whatever you might have in mind for the negotiations that is outside the bounds of these principles. That is, it will have an effective role in getting the parties to realize that bad ideas won't get support. But it will also give them some useful ideas as to where and how a negotiation might be able to achieve success. And while if we had done this the first year after Israeli independence, the parties would have totally distrusted us, we now have been around for all these years and know pretty well where the bodies are buried and where the process has to go to be successful. If we did that, we would have to do several other things. We would have to say, I think as a matter of honesty, that we would be prepared to support anything that the two parties could freely agree to at the negotiating table with no force, so that we were not excluding things that might come up that we might not have thought about. Thirdly, I think we have to discuss those ideas with the parties. But then I believe transparency is fundamentally important. We have to put out in public those ideas. And I would put out in public those ideas in a way that said, this is what we presented to the parties. This is what the parties said to us about those ideas. This is what we could accept and why. And this is what we couldn't accept. And these are the reasons why we put forth our original ideas. Totally transparent. Now, others have suggested, and I join them in this, that this is not likely to produce progress. It may, but it may not. But I would be prepared, if it doesn't produce progress, to suggest the United States take these to the UN Security Council, put those ideas in the form of a resolution that fairly expressed those ideas, and see if you couldn't get unanimity in the Security Council for it, and I suspect with a little work you could. That means then that while the parties may not have accepted it, like the one substantive resolution that still exists on Middle East peace, territory for peace, these eight principles would exist as part of an international framework for a successful negotiation. And while maybe this administration couldn't get there, probably highly unlikely, it would be putting a deposit with respect to the international community down on the table for the parties to work with, which one time sooner or later, in my view, could become the basis for further progress. This may take a need. It may need change of government in one country or another. It may need change of leadership. Palestinians have been talking about change of leadership. Israel is a democracy. Netanyahu has a one-vote majority in his parliament. If these ideas are useful and people see the value of them, it can help to condition the political atmosphere in both parties for what it is that they can live with, what they can receive, and what they can't. If we do this, we probably will need to consult closely with our friends. In this case, the UN, the Russians, and the EU. So that, in fact, we are able, when it comes to it, to say, yes, we can all agree. These are the things that make sense. We won't stand in the way of a negotiated solution, but these are the kinds of things we're fully prepared to support. Well, it's a different approach. Do I think it's going to work? Well, I don't think so. Syria is taking all the oxygen and Iraq out of the Middle East, but maybe it'll work for somebody in the future. So, in any event, all of my best ideas are not accepted. I understand that. I've been around a long while. But it's one that I hope can work. Look, I've talked a long time. I've given you, I hope, some granularity about the problem. I've talked about some of the problems and issues as I see them. So why don't you talk?
It's working. We have time for a couple questions. Does anyone have a question? If you'd just like to introduce yourself and speak clearly into the mic. I'll start back here and then work our way up.
How are you? Thank you for being here. I'm Ben Rogers. Firstly, I'd like to compliment you on your shirt. I have the exact same one. Secondly, aside from the Middle East, I'm actually interested in what you think about climate change and the Paris Agreement. So could you shed some light on that, please?
Yes, I will. I'm not an expert, although I was at one time for 3.5 years, a long time ago, in charge of environment science, oceans and similar questions in State Department. So I followed it with care. One, I think climate change really exists. As the president said last night, 200 countries believe that. If the opposing political party doesn't, that's not necessarily the answer to the question. Secondly, I believe that the important moves made at Paris are very significant, but not yet obviously the full answer. We have more to go. Most of the best scientific judgment believes that we probably have already used up half of the carbon deposit, if I can call it that way, that's necessary to get to a 2 degree centigrade temperature rise as the final piece. And we have done that in a way that now we have to, in the next whatever it is, 20, 30 years, accomplish that same level of restriction, but with clearly an indication that our carbon production is not yet ready to be muscled into that framework by the government's concern. What we have achieved at Paris, I think, is very important because we have begun to crack the problem that existed for a long period of time of doubt about the reality. Secondly, even more importantly, we have begun to try to find a way to crash through on the answer that the big developing countries felt that they had been asked to take on a big share of the burden because, in fact, the U.S. and the other developed countries had gotten economically and developmentally where they are by, in fact, putting all that carbon in the atmosphere ahead of them. And so the question of what was a fair division and how to shape that, as well as the target to strike for, are all there. The problem we now have to face, I think, is what is clearly serious doubts about the adequacy of the present set of steps to meet the targets, and some doubts, since everybody has said these are our best efforts, approaches, that there is no binding international commitment with respect to these, only a best efforts approach on the part of the key governments. Now, we've been at this a while, and Kyoto didn't work a long time ago, and we made this one get closer to working. So I see this as a process. I think that while 2 degrees centigrade has some pretty wild consequences, we may have to begin to look at 3 and 4 degrees centigrade and the consequences before we can take the next steps to come back and be closer to meeting the targets in a reasonable time frame. So good news, but not perfect.
My name is Kim Gavidis. My question is in regards to globalization with the faster and faster ability to communicate and travel over long distances. There's been a lot of discussion about the merits and also challenges of globalization. In one of Thomas Piketty's books, The Economics of Inequality, he touches on the idea of new American imperialism, mostly in regards to outsourcing of jobs and other economic endeavors to India and other areas of Southeast Asia. While we don't just directly control the economies in countries like in the Middle East, places like Syria and Israel, we do play a pretty significant role in policing those areas. Do you think that that is inherently going to be a challenge in the rise of globalization as we attempt to preserve languages and cultures that are not strictly Western?
Yes, I do. And I think it may not be an insuperable challenge if we bring to it the kind of way you expressed the question to me, an effort to try to understand where the particular problems are and how we can think about moving them. It's quite fascinating because one of the reasons we've had problems in this country in the last 10 years in getting through trade agreements is that the political parties have reversed their positions. The Democrats used to be in favor of free trade. The Republicans much more cautious about it. Now, for a whole series of reasons, the Democrats in large measure because of a deep concern in labor unions about job offshoring, have become much more skeptical. And the Republicans about a deep concern that globalization is necessary both to be able to be competitive because they can find the most competitive labor costs, and at the same time, for many of them, the participation in local production helps them market their products because they are locally made or partly locally made. So how do we square the circle on these things? Well, one of the things that we have been doing, and I had fundamental concerns at the beginning that we should assume in our trade negotiations the requirement to undertake serious obligations with respect to the environment and labor. I'm now convinced that I was wrong, that these are important. They're important because, one, we were just talking about climate change, and obviously real assumption of binding requirements in a trade negotiation on things like carbon production would be a very helpful adjunct to what we've done in Paris. Secondly, if in fact we begin to require is part of our trading relationship foreign countries to meet much higher standards in treating their labor fairly, we are going to have what I would call perhaps less rapid offshoring and more fair offshoring and perhaps more respect for American labor where, in fact, those standards in general have to be met. And as a result, they're a cost. And if they're a cost, obviously, they have to be absorbed in the product and so on. So I think that's a way to at least think about part of this. Are we going to see the disappearance of cultures? I think, yes, we are, just the way that we're seeing the disappearance of species. One of the great values, obviously, of globalization is we, if we have time to listen, or time to read or see, we know almost anything about everything everywhere. That didn't exist in the past. And in my lifetime, we've had periods when we found tribes that had never before seen civilization. But we can see lists of languages disappearing. Is that good or bad? I don't know the answer to that question. I think that it is important for us to be able to understand more about how languages develop, what processes people have adopted in thinking about and creating language. Can it be made more useful? Can we find ways to record and guard and keep old languages that are going for whatever future value they may be to the man's history? And I think that cultures are changing. This country has such an enormous impact on worldwide culture. I'm not sure that I agree that all of it is great. I'm not a cultural imperialist in that sense. But I think it's there. And to some extent, it's part of human freedom to be able to choose and adapt and have the opportunity to look more broadly. One final point. I think it is our obligation to the people who follow us, our kids, grandchildren, and so on, to do the best that we possibly can to give them the kind of education that will allow them to think responsibly and handle the changes that are taking place that you describe with such rapidity. I think that it is significantly important. I am deeply disturbed by the polarization of politics in this country, and to some extent, I believe that is a failure in secondary schools to teach people anything about governments. what they are, how they work, what their responsibilities are, what are the principles. And, you know, I don't think you're educated unless at least you have some knowledge of that. And that goes to one of your most important responsibilities, voting. And, of course, you should vote. But hopefully you can vote wisely because you have an educational background that allows you to make the decisions that you need to make to meet the challenges that the elected officials have to address by understanding through what it is that you've learned in an educational system about how and in what way those things work most effectively.
My name is Elliot Fleming. I'm just curious, I know that you had said that almost in anything that we want to do in the Middle East, Russia is going to need to be a partner. And it kind of seems like in recent time that Russia has been essentially opposed to almost every option that we've put forward. I'm curious if there's, with your interaction as ambassador to Russia, if there is something different besides, you know, the Putin approach to the world inside the Russian government, and if there's active voices that are against him inside the government that would give us a better option in the future.
Yeah, I think they are. I think that's the good news. The bad news, however, the system is so tightly constraining them at the moment that I don't see much development of that. And I watch carefully because your question takes me to where I am in looking at this question. I think the future of Russia is going to be determined by Russians. The really interesting question, will they have the freedom to be able to do this? And part of it is the existential physical freedom, but part of it is also the mental capacity to understand world complexities. A good bit of Putin's policy is built on the exaltation of Russian nationalism. And a lot of it, and we bear some responsibility for this, is of course based on the hard times that Russia has been through before and after the collapse of communism. And some of the idealization of some of the past history, and some of the lack of understanding of what change has really brought about in Russia. So those are the difficult challenges. Now, the bad news is that the polls are still high in favor of Putin. But if you were an everyday Russian on the street and some guy came up to you and said, I'm taking a poll, do you like Mr. Putin? What would you say? Hate the guy. No. So the polls, in my view, are losing some reliability. I don't know how much, but some. It's true. There are a large number of people who like this exercise in what is nationalistic enthusiasm. Some of it see regaining Russia's rightful position. They want to be the big player, at least in their part of the world. They see some of that was lost. Maybe not through their own fault. The really interesting question is that Mr. Putin has really got a tin ear on economics. And if you look at the economic situation, it's not getting better. And the economic situation has produced in the last 2 months, interestingly enough, a strike in many parts of Russia of the truckers. In part because the government, to recover economic funds, has put a special tax on road transportation. And that's meant that people are using truck traffic less, and the drivers are getting less money, and there are more of them out of work. And so it's taking that particular point. And this is beginning to show that Abraham Lincoln was right when he said, you can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time. And I think that applies most places. It applies in Russia. And so are we seeing the beginning of change or merely just an upsurge that he'll squelch? Well, the more he squelches, the more I think he's making his problem worse. The second question for Mr. Putin is international. Mr. Putin grew up as a middle-grade intelligence agent. Don't mean to disparage him because I said middle-grade, but that's sort of where he was. And middle grade intelligence agents sometimes have this idea that if we can cobble together and confect and build up and invent all kinds of useful propaganda, it doesn't have to be 100% true. We can help move people around where we want them. And so he's grown up in recent years on the notion that what I say is important, whether it's true or not, is a different question. So now if you were President Obama or Angela Merkel, and you had this guy who was suddenly telling you all sorts of stuff that turned out to be first-rate BS, would you go to an international meeting with him and accept his word that everything was going to be simply splendid because we could all agree? No. That's another problem for him, because he wants to be a big player with the big team. So maybe Syria shows some change. I don't know yet. But they're doing some things in Syria that are helpful, just as they stuck with us through thick and thin on Iran. So he isn't 100%, if I could put it this way, dead-end kid. But he isn't 100% where we would like to see him, but we're never going to get him there. So the really interesting challenge is diplomacy is taking challenges and making them into opportunities. And that's the job we have to do with Putin. Now, how far we can go and how long, I don't know. But I think he's seeing some of this stuff coming back to bite him. And that's when we should be taking advantage of the opportunity to move things ahead. Because we have a lot of things we can do with the Russians that I think are mutually advantageous, but haven't caught on yet. One of those is another round of the reduction of nuclear weapons and delivery vehicles. We're putting $350 billion into our nuclear program over the next 15 to 20 years. Russians, a similar amount. I think we have adequate weapons and delivery vehicles. Why would we want to put that way, throw away $700 billion when a whole lot of other things we could do with that would make a lot more difference, both to our people and to our future and to our prosperity? So those are the kind of really interesting questions that we have to face up to and face up. So thank you for a question. I led you along a long trail, but I hope I got you someplace. Thanks. Thank you all very much.
That was great to see today's forum.
This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss, your humble curator and producer of this program. Thanks for listening.